to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
With the precision of an investigative journalist, Susanna Cahalan recreates what happened to her in the New York Times bestselling memoir, Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. She knows the terror of what it's like to be an individual without a medical diagnosis, a human being lost in a sea of clinical maybes. Cahalan sounds calm, deliberate, and decisive on the telephone, and as she describes her descent into mental hell, it's almost as if she's speaking about someone else. One moment, she's a young journalist charging uphill in the competitive world of New York City media, and the next, she's paranoid, delusional, catatonic, and near death. Luckily, she did find clinical clarity. The diagnosis, anti-NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis, a disease only discovered in 2007. Cahalan's back at work now at the New York Post. She's writing book reviews, science, and health articles, all with a new perspective. In this one-to-one podcast, I asked her if she was a different person now and how she's changed. She told me you can't go through something like this and not. It has changed everything. Susanna, thank you for joining me in One-to-One. Why don't we start with you describing what happened? One day you're this carefree journalist, and the next day you're consumed by a raging illness of unknown dimensions. Mm-hmm. What happened?
You know, it started slowly at first, and then very quickly escalated. But at first, it was just kind of feeling off, you know, just feeling, you know, not like yourself, just like having a bad day, but that, you know, many bad days in a row. So, you know, I remember kind of just feeling lethargic. I couldn't concentrate at work. You know, I just thought, oh, you know, I have some kind of flu, or, you know, I'm just kind of in a bad mood. That's what I was kind of cropping it up to. But then, you know, looking back now, like at the time I didn't connect these things, but I also started getting paranoid. And again, it's something that I didn't realize was a problem at the time, but only looking back now do I realize that that was kind of the beginning. I began to believe that my house was invaded by bed bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
But presumably you live in New York City,
yeah,
so it could have been invaded
by bed
bugs.
How's that crazy?
Right.
You know, and in fact, a lot of people had bed bugs, and it was a serious, you know, scare, especially at the time. But my response to it was uncharacteristic. So I, you know, I hired a exterminator to come look at my house, even though I only had a bite or two in my arm. It could have been any kind of bug. And the exterminator actually told me, I don't think you have bed bugs. But I said, you know, you need to exterminate anyway. And I became obsessed with it. I dreamed about it. You know, I really fixated on that. And that to me shows that's not really my personality. So looking back, that kind of shows me that was the beginning of when things started to go wrong.
As the illness moved forward and you became more consumed with paranoia, you became sicker, describe what was happening to you.
So it happened in stages. You know, the lethargy was first. Then I started noticing that I couldn't control my emotions. So, you know, one second I would be the happiest I've ever felt in my life, you know, beaming. So, you know, I couldn't even sit still, very manic. And the next moment, I mean, I'm talking seconds later, I would be hysterically crying. And this is when I was in the newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting at my newspaper trying to write stories, and I couldn't sit down. I couldn't sit still. And that's kind of the next stage that I noticed things were going wrong. And then, you know, I also stopped being able to listen to what someone was saying. So say if I was interviewing someone and taking notes, I found that I could no longer hear what someone was saying and actually translate it into words. So I was having some cognitive issues then as well that started to escalate at the time.
And you thought that you were having a quote-unquote breakdown.
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, I think many people who were seeing me then did, especially people in the newsroom, because I'm sitting there crying hysterically and then laughing and, you know, all over the place and babbling. I was babbling about how I wanted to do these hard-hitting investigations and I wanted to be a serious journalist. And people definitely thought that I was having some kind of breakdown. I went on the internet, which is probably the worst thing you can do, and tried to diagnose myself and came up with bipolar disorder as a diagnosis. And I was you know, completely sure that that was what I was, that was what I had. I had bipolar disorder, and frankly, I was very relieved to have that diagnosis because I didn't know what was happening, and it made so much sense, and I felt like I belonged to this club of creatives. I'm a creative person. But it was not the right answer, ultimately.
Talk about the misdiagnosis. So you saw, on the one hand, psychiatrists who were giving you one diagnosis. One of the psychiatrists said to you that you were partying too much, you were coming off alcohol detox, and then you started going to physicians to get a diagnosis. Can you talk about that period?
Sure. So the first physician that I saw actually diagnosed me with mono. And, you know, that made sense because I was really tired. I was lethargic. And then I went back, or I returned to him again, and that he was actually, the physician was the one who diagnosed me with alcohol withdrawal. He was a neurologist. And then I also went to a psychiatrist at the same time, and she confirmed my suspicion that I had bipolar disorder and actually put me on antipsychotic medication. Mm-hmm. So in the span of about a week, I had three different diagnoses.
What is it like as a individual to the book is dedicated to those without a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that as human beings we're able to do that other species are not is explain ourselves, is communicate about ourselves. Can you describe what it's like to have a medical condition or an illness that you can't find a diagnosis for, that you can't explain, that you can't come to any conclusions about?
It's utterly terrifying and lonely. And, you know, I that was one of the, you know, at this point in when I was sick, I was still capable of being coherent. Later on, I lost that ability. But I would have these moments of insight thinking, what is wrong with me? What is making me feel this way? And no one could explain it. And that was so frustrating and so frightening. I feel for people who out there, many people out there who don't have proper diagnoses or misdiagnosed. I mean, it's just, you know, not having a name and not having an explanation is just so, you know, all encompassingly terrifying. I mean, really, and really, again, lonely, very lonely.
I kept on thinking of Sartre's No Exit when I was reading the book, you know, that someone stuck and just not being able to, the fear, the paranoia, the sort of claustrophobia, mm-hmm, of not being able to be diagnosed. And then you really descend into a utter hell.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting parallel, and I think it's a really apt one because, you know, when I was capable of having these conversations with myself, it did feel very claustrophobic because I was experiencing these emotions and these feelings, and I was seeing things that weren't there. You know, I was hallucinating, and you feel trapped in this body. Why am I experiencing this? What is going on? And when no one can give you an answer, you know, it kind of completely flips your worldview upside down.
I said Sartre is actually Camus, but I screwed up my French authors. You're a journalist, so I assume that, you know, putting most people that I've spoken to about your book just marvel at the way in which you were, the narrative, the way in which you were able to describe the worst case, the part where you were in the hospital, you were in hell, you were totally sort of subsumed by your illness.
Yeah.
At the height of this illness, you're completely out of it, basically. And yet you paint a beautiful narrative. What was the process like to create and recreate what happened?
Well, first off, thank you so much for saying that. Secondly, I mean, I don't remember anything pretty much from that time, with the exception of a few hallucinations that I remember. So most of that was a process of journalism, you know. So I had to rely on other people and other sources to piece it together. So in a lot of ways, it was kind of, for that part of the book at least, it's really not a memoir. It's really a piece of journalism. So the process that I did was, the first thing I did when I wanted to write this book was I wrote down everything that I remembered before, I knew on some level that once you talk to people, your memories change. So I wanted to have one kind of, you know, piece, evidence that this is, you know, these are mine. You know, these are mine. And so from there, I got the medical records. And there were thousands of pages of medical records. And from there, I started putting a timeline together what was happening day by day in the hospital. You know, this time the nurse came in at, you know, 12:30. The nurse did vitals at this. You know, so it was kind of that process. And then from there, I started to interview family and friends, doctors and nurses. And it was almost like building a case, you know, the best possible case of what happened during that time.
As the illness progresses, at one point you became catatonic, and the you're in ICU, and no one can solve this problem. What were you told about the physicians, the neurologists who were, you know, part of your team about their frustration with not being able to solve this?
Yeah, you know, I talked to. We did have a head doctor on the case, whose name I changed in the book, but, you know, he's very smart, lovely man, you know, one of the best neurologists, epileptologists, you know, in the country. And he was very frustrated, I know, behind the scenes. You know, he tried not to show that to my parents, but, on paper, I'm a perfectly healthy person, but in person, I can't even put together a sentence. I'm garbling words. I'm drooling. I can hardly even swallow liquids. You know, I can't even walk on my own. Obviously, you know, getting worse. This disease is getting more and more intense. But on paper, nothing is showing up. So there was a lot of question of, there was a question of, is this, you know, a quote, psychological disease? You know, is this organic versus psychological? You know, what could be causing this? You know, there were a lot of questions, and there were a lot of tests done. I mean, every panel of tests you can possibly think were conducted on me. I mean, just blood work sent everywhere across the country. Nothing's coming back. So I think for them, and I think for doctors who face these situations, it's very frustrating, you know, undeniably, I think.
When did your illness begin to get the first ray of light, begin to get some real clinical clarity, and how did that come about?
So I think, without a doubt, it starts with Dr. Suhail Najjar, who is a clinician, neurologist and epileptologist at NYU. And he was called on the case because he had this kind of reputation as being a little bit of a maverick. He was kind of called in to consult on cases when doctors couldn't figure it out.
And he was called in like in day 24 or something
21,
like that.
Yeah.
21 of
the
your,
third week, yeah.
The third week of your being in a harrowing, you know, just state of illness in the hospital.
Exactly. Exactly. And, yeah, so he was called in for that. And, you know, he just immediately, and again, I don't remember any of this, so this is all coming through the lens of my parents and him. But, he has an incredible manner. Just the way he speaks to his patients is very much like a friend. You know, he is there to, he's very clear that he wants to help you. And I'm not saying that other doctors didn't want to help, but he is just so kind, and you just want to, you just believe in him when he comes in. And my parents totally did. They thought this man is going to figure this out. And he sat with my parents and with me, and at that point I couldn't really talk. So he was trying to get a wide-ranging health history, which actually had not really been done before. And he took three handwritten pages, and on those pages you see bed bugs. I had numbness on one side. That's in there. I had heart rate fluctuations. I also had hallucinations. All those things are in his notes. And at one point, he turned to me and he had this kind of eureka moment, and he thought, I'm gonna do a simple test and see what happens. And so he handed me a piece of paper, and it was a completely unlined piece of paper, and he asked me to draw a clock. And it took me a few times to get the circle. I couldn't even really draw a circle. And so finally, I drew the circle, and very slowly, I drew each number in, and I perseverated, which means, drawing the number several times. And so it took me a long time to do the clock. And when I was finished, Dr. Najjar almost applauded. I mean, he was so excited when he saw what I did. He looked down and saw that I had squished all the numbers on the right-hand side of the clock so that the 12 landed where the 6 o'clock should have been. So it was almost a perfect specimen, and it revealed to him basically that my brain was not seeing the world in the way that it should. It wasn't operating in the way that it should. It was suffering from visual spatial neglect. So I was actually having neglect on the left side. I just was ignoring the left side of my universe. And for him, this was a key moment, because prior to this, you know, people were debating about, was this a psychological condition? Was I suffering from schizoaffective disorder, which was a prevailing diagnosis at the time, or was this something that we haven't figured out? And when he did that clock, that was proof to him that this was a quote, an organic disease. This was a neurological condition. And, you know, this gave him the kind of confidence to move forward and ultimately do a brain biopsy to confirm that.
And he basically, at that point, turned to your parents or told your parents that essentially your brain was on fire.
Yes, he said that. Yeah, that was his kind of layman's way of saying that there was serious inflammation in my brain, and that there was impairment there. And it's amazing, because you think that most parents would be pretty scared to hear those words, your daughter's brain is on fire. But they were actually relieved, because, again, you know, we talked before about the idea of not having an answer, not having a diagnosis, not having an explanation. Even though this is a kind of amorphous explanation, it was something. And they latched onto that. They were very excited to hear that.
And how quickly after that did you receive the diagnosis of an anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis?
Within a week, I received the diagnosis. And in the meantime, he had done, Dr. Najjar, he did a brain biopsy. And with that, he was able to prove that there was inflammation in my brain. And he actually looked at that under a microscope and saw a lot of inflammation there. And he sent my spinal fluid out to University of Pennsylvania, which at the time was the one place in the world that actually tested for this disease.
And with this disease, essentially, one's immune system is at war with itself.
Exactly.
Can you expand on the knowledge of that disease, what knowledge you've gained, and what you know about it now?
Yes. So anti-NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis is one of, I think now, about 17 different types of autoimmune encephalitides. So with anti-NMDA, the body's immune system targets and attaches to the NMDA receptors in the brain. And the NMDA receptors are located all over the brain, you know, in breathing areas. I mean, and every single part of the brain has an NMDA receptor, but in highest concentrations in the frontal lobes and the hippocampus, which kind of explain why you have these a lot of memory deficits, and also you have behavioral changes as well. If this disease goes unchecked, you know, there are many things that could happen, including death and cognitive disability. So the disease itself was only discovered or named in 2007, and I was treated in 2009. And at the time, you know, I was one of the first 200 patients to be diagnosed with this disease.
You know, I thought about it. Several things struck me when I was reading the book, and one was luck.
Oh,
and
yeah.
How much good luck played such a significant part of your survival. Luck that you had parents who pursued a diagnosis and a treatment with a vengeance. Luck that you had this ferocious boyfriend who stuck with you, a loyal boyfriend, right at the hospital all the time. Luck that you went to the right institution. Luck that all of this confluence. What now, with a perspective away, what do you think of? How do you look at the term, and how do you grapple with how luck played a significant part of your life?
It's at once really scary and unsettling, and also I'm just so grateful. You know, I realize very much how lucky I am, and I also have always been a very, person, you know, who's been concerned about luck and superstitious. So it's unsettling, and it reminds me of the people who aren't lucky. And that has been motivating me in a lot of the things I've been doing consequently after my book has been published, and, you know, helping spread the word, because, you know, what I hope is one day that luck does not play a role in this disease. I mean, there's always the idea of luck, because not everyone responds fully to treatment. I did. That's another layer of luck that I had. But, you know, besides that, I really think, I hope that the playing field is leveled and that everyone has the same luck as I did.
When you look back now at what happened, what's the different perspective you have since years have passed?
Wow. I mean, you know, it's a hard question to answer. I mean, I'm a different person. I mean, fundamentally the same person, you know, in terms of likes and dislikes and, you know, personality traits. But I think, you know, just who I am now is very much a different person than the person I was before. And my whole life is very much broken up into pre and post this disease. And I think about them. Oh, that was before I was sick, or that was after I was sick. And, you know, it's changed everything. It's changed my goals in life. It's changed, you know, where I put my energies and my interests, you know, and it's changed the way I appreciate life, too. And as cheesy as that might sound, I think you can't help but come away from a near-death experience, especially at a young age, and not look at your life a little bit differently.
If you thought about what information a patient should have about their conditions versus what should be withheld, I mean, you know, as I was reading the book, I kept on wondering if at some point too much information was bombarding you. And when is too much information not helpful? Or should there always be transparency?
That is a great question. And I think it's a multifaceted one. I can tell you that the time that there was a group of, I guess, interns coming in, or, you know, medical students coming in, and they were discussing my cases if I wasn't there, and they said she might have to get her ovaries removed. And my dad freaked out because we never heard this. This was completely new information. And honestly, looking back, not entirely false, but not entirely true either. But it was something that, you know, we weren't ready to hear. We had just gotten diagnosis. You know, we're happy to have an answer. And then all of a sudden, this new information has come in. That was too much information. And I do think that there are times when there is too much information. You know, I don't think that, you know, for example, if you have a cancer diagnosis and you're given, you know, you have X amount of months or years to live, I'm not sure if that also is helpful. I think it depends on the person in a lot of ways, and where they are in treatment and where they are in the diagnosis and where they are in recovery. But I do think that in some cases there can be too much information, but I also, that scares me too, because, you know, personally as a journalist and as, you know, going through this disease, we wanted as much information as possible, and, you know, any withholding information could have been harmful too. So I think it's an extremely complicated subject.
Is there any broad statement or any comment that you'd like to tell the medical community at this point, you know, 6 years, 5 years after you begin your descent into this illness? Is there anything that you want to get off your chest? You want to basically say, if only this, or is it
there's
a great
so
sense
much.
Of gratitude?
Don't open this up. There's so much. Okay, well, there's mm-hmm. many things. I'm just going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think Dr. Najjar shows the power of the patient history and the patient narrative and how important it is to listen to patients and their parents and their families. You know, that, I think, is supremely important. I also think the awareness that autoimmune encephalitis exists is extremely important. And the thing that's so incredible about this disease is that you can be utterly devastated. And I've now listened to many people's stories who have had this disease, and there are stories of people who are in coma, who coma for 6 months, people who are very close to death, people who look like they'll never return, who come back. And that's what's very exciting about these diseases, because you can recover and be utterly devastated at its height. And so that is another kind of aspect that I hope to share. And another thing, my final, I promise I won't take all day with this, but my final suggestion to doctors is that this disease, autoimmune encephalitis, requires the cooperation of many different disciplines. So you, for example, in my treatment, you need a psychiatrist to help monitor the behavioral changes. You need a neurologist. You need an immunologist. You need a cardiologist. So you need all these people to come together to care for you, to properly care. There's not just one doctor. And I think that is a really important lesson to learn generally, how, you know, multidisciplinary care is really important to patient success. That I think is a really important thing to impart as well.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I kept on scratching my head when I was reading the book is, how is it being paid for? You know, you have this intense, you know, you also are lucky. I found out at the end of the book is that, you know, you had great insurance from your employer. You also mm-hmm. had family that was able to, you know, add into that. But do you look at it differently now that we have a national health care program? Has that weighed any insight into, you know, when you think of how do people pay for this? How do people with a severe, significant illness get treated?
Oh, I mean, I've heard some nightmare stories. I mean, before and after, you know, Obamacare. But, you know, basically it's, you know, I think that the health insurance company is totally, I mean, there needs to be changes. And I've heard some nightmare stories of people who've had autoimmune encephalitis who haven't had as good insurance of it that I had. And really, I mean, you know, for an IVIG treatment that I had 20. They cost anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 a infusion. And I had 20. So, I mean, it's a very high cost to treat this disease. But think about the long-term care that would be required and the money required to take care of a sick person for the rest of their life. So, you know, I don't know what the answer is, but clearly it's broken, and you know, I don't know how to fix it. But, you know, again, that's another luck factor that I had, that I didn't have to, you know, that I wasn't decimated. I didn't go bankrupt because of this disease. You know, and I've talked to, you know, a friend of mine's daughter had this disease, and the they had to battle for a year to get her treatment with the insurance company, and he only succeeded in having them pay for her treatment when he threatened to go to the media. So that's terrible. And you know, again, I don't know what the answer is to it, but I can tell you now that I don't have the same insurance that I had when I was sick, and I had an ear infection the other day, and it cost me $300 mm-hmm. to fix a swimmer's ear, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not good either.
The other thing that is really apparent is that you have and you had fierce warriors surrounding you, your parents, your boyfriend. And I would presume that you would say is that they really help keep you alive.
Oh, yeah.
What if you didn't? A lot of people don't. Any thoughts about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think had they not been there, I would not be here now. Without it, I mean, undoubtedly. I mean, I couldn't have fought for myself. I didn't have the abilities, you know. So who would have been there insisting that Dr. Najjar or another doctor take the case? You know, what would have happened to me? I don't know.
What do you tell people when you hear from them about serious illness and the like, and they don't have warriors who stand beside them?
You know, it's, what can I say? I mean, that, you know, you hope that someone has someone who can help advocate for them. If they can't advocate for themselves, which is something that I try to help people do, you hope that they have someone there who can help help advocate for them, you know, in their place. Because, again, it's so impossible to navigate that world by yourself.
Mm-hmm. At one point, you are in early stages of recovery. You're with your boyfriend, you go to a party, and people are asking you how you're doing. And mm-hmm. and their questions seem sort of, as we all, when, you know, when someone dies, or how are you doing? Mm-hmm. It seems lame and insufficient. And I wondered if you can help us understand or help show, how do you show and tell someone who's coming out of a serious illness in recovery that you care without being intrusive? What's the way to communicate that to someone? Have you thought about that?
I have. You know, I think that it's a universal. I heard this from someone, and I don't remember the source, but I think it's really wise. When people would say to me, what can I do to help you? Or, you know, How can I help you? You know, you don't, as a person who is either grieving or surviving an illness, you don't have time or the motivation to tell people, oh, I need you to do this for me, or please do that for me, or come hang out with me. You know, the best thing you can do for someone in a situation, I think, is just to do something, to go out there and be with the person. You know, the most kind of powerful things that people did for me during that time was just come and hang out with me when I was recovering and I wasn't myself, and to just treat me like a normal person and watch a show with me, or, you know, go out to dinner with me. I mean, those people who did those things, I mean, I have just such fondness and love for them, you know, for their generosity during that time.
Have you come to a different sort of understanding of what it means to be human?
Yes. I mean, I think you have to. You know, never before did I ever, you know, think about the fact that how we are all just kind of hanging by this very thin thread, not only in terms of our health and, you know, physically our health, but mentally and emotionally our health. You know, for me, a receptor in my brain I didn't even know existed. I didn't know what a receptor was. But you kind of tweaked those receptors, and I completely changed who I was. That's kind of disconcerting, I would say. So that's you know, that view of humanity, that we can so be changed, you know, so changed, you know, not only physically, again, but, you know, our personality, everything that we consider ourselves to be, by this some disease that messes with some kind of tiny part of your brain, is, you know, it makes you question a lot of things, I think.
Several times you wrote about the need to have power or to be powerful, and during the depths of your illness, why was power so important? You know, I was intrigued by, you used the word several times in the book, power. What did power mean to you, and why was it important?
When I was sick.
Right.
You know, it's so interesting. I think, looking back, I think it was a delusion of grandiosity. I think I was suffering from many delusions of paranoia, and a very common delusion is the delusion of grandiosity. I think it was because I was so powerless and because I didn't understand what was going on. I had no explanation. I had to kind of, my body and my mind were creating these artificial senses of power. I think that's what was going on.
You never really discovered the cause of your illness, and it seems to be based upon genetic predisposition and unknown environmental factors. And I wondered if there is somewhere a deep fear of still not knowing, and what does that mean in the future for you?
I mean, there is a fear. I think, you know, because there is a relapse rate too. It's about, I think it's about 18% now of a relapse rate, which is scary. And I've had, what it means in the future now, honestly, is that when some small thing happens to me, say I had vertigo a couple, like 6 months ago, and that so thoroughly freaked me out, I thought I was getting sick again. I had to do a barrage of tests, you know, tons of MRIs and all this blood work just to tell me that I had kind of vertigo, an inner ear thing with vertigo. So for the rest of my life, I mean, it is kind of a little bit of a specter, you know, following me around, you know, the fear of it happening again. It doesn't change the way I live my life. It doesn't, you know, change any of my life decisions, but it does follow me. So I think that's something that I will live with.
What do you recommend to people who think they may have an autoimmune condition that might cause their psychiatric problems, but their doctor doesn't take it seriously? What do you tell them?
The first thing I would say, not to plug this, but I'm a board member of a nonprofit called the Autoimmune Encephalitis Alliance, and I would urge any person who thinks anything is going on that, you know, that they think it's autoimmune related, or they just want to talk to someone, to reach out to the AE Alliance.
And what's the URL?
Oh, it's aealliance.org.
And as you talk with current patients and their families, have you seen a shift towards greater understanding of the disease and other similar forms of autoimmune encephalitis?
I think it depends. I think it depends on what doctor you have. It's really case by case. Every time I want to say, yes, we're learning so much and we've come so far, then I hear a story that really just bursts my bubble, because, you know, you hear about a doctor who doesn't believe in it and thinks it's a psychiatric condition and commits the person to a psychiatric hospital. And every time you hear those stories, it brings you back a couple of steps. But I think generally the industry, they know about this disease now in a way that they didn't know when I was sick. And now there are, you know, again, like I was on a 200 and something. Now there's not one place that tests for the disease, so I can't tell you an exact number, but it's definitely in probably in the tens of thousands now.
Now you're back in the New York. You're back in the New York Post. You're back being a journalist, writer again. What sort of things are you working on?
You know, I do here. I do book reviews and a lot of science and health related articles, which I really enjoy now. Which is something that happened after I was sick.
And what's the status of the motion picture? Are you ready for your close up?
Oh gosh. Well, keep your fingers crossed for that because it was optioned, but. Who knows?
It was optioned by Charlize Theron, right?
Yes, she's producer, and Dakota Fanning is, you know, slated to. It's so bizarre to even say it, but yes, Dakota Fanning is attached to star as me.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your taking the time to talk.
Oh, thank you so much for your very thoughtful interview.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One to One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.